You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 22nd of November. The cover story of the latest issue of E, the environmental magazine, talks about passive houses and says that the new houses are so energy efficient, they make heating and cooling practically irrelevant. The passive house standard includes very specific requirements related to energy intensity for heating, cooling, and primary energy, as well as airtightness. These houses are really airtight, and it results in energy use reduction of 90%. They are more expensive to build than the average home, and they're much more popular in Europe than they are in the United States. They're just starting to get built here in the United States, and we'll talk about where they're getting built, if there will be more of them, why they're much more popular in Europe, how expensive they are, what materials are used, where we can find them. Are they in the south? Are they in the north? Are they better for cold climates or hot climates? Our guest is Christine McDonald, a journalist and author of the book Green Ink, an environmental insider reveals how a good cause has gone bad. Christine started the blog to talk about environmental news and quality of life issues where she lives in Washington, D.C. and around the world, and has written extensively on a number of issues, the BP disaster, the new environmental activists, and this story in E, the environmental magazine. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send us an email, that would be fine. That address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Hi, Christine. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah. So tell me, give me a description of a passive house. What is it?
Well, they can look like anything. They can be really new constructions with very modern looks to them, or they can be very traditional houses. There are also retrofits going on where they retrofit an existing home. So they can look like just about anything. The key here is very careful construction to make sure that the houses are very airtight, and they also use a device that exchanges the air, the indoor air, with the outdoor air. These houses have very good air quality because about a third of the air in the entire house is being exchanged for fresh air every hour. But the key is they use devices that actually take the heat out of the air before it leaves the building and exchange it onto the new air coming in. So they retain that heat. Heat energy. It's actually thought of in terms of energy. They retain the heat energy, and they put it onto the fresh air coming in, and that way the houses maintain a very cozy environment, and they only need to be heated or cooled depending the time of year and where you live by just a few degrees.
Huh? And is that an elaborate device to do what you just described?
You would think it would be, but actually it's not. Here in the U.S., in Europe, they tend to use something called a heat recovery ventilator, because in Germany, well, in Northern Europe, where this system has become very popular, they really don't have a problem in the summertime with heat, with hot summers, hot muggy summers. But here in the U.S., especially in regions like Washington, D.C., and further south, where we have very hot, muggy times of year, many of the builders are using something called an energy recovery ventilator, and these are not new. They've been used in hospitals and office building constructions for many years.
Hmm.
So they're just being used. What's new about it is they're being used in residential projects.
Mm-hmm. Now, when it comes to the construction of a passive home, we're talking about very thick walls, aren't we?
Well, they do need more insulation. Some of the builders I talked to said they spent as much as 30% more on the insulation, but they aren't, it isn't so much insulation that the house, that it has to be a very boxy looking house. For instance, some of the projects that I profiled in my article include a what the builder is calling a new American four square. It looks just like an old four square, which is a type of construction that's been around for more than 100 years. You find them all over the country. They're kind of that faux farmhouse looking house, that used to be sold, they used to sell these kits, these building kits, through the Sears and Roebuck catalog.
Great.
And it's here in suburban Washington, a new American Foursquare that will be a passive house is about to be completed. And another project I talked about was a retrofit of a brownstone in Brooklyn, New York. So they can look like anything.
Mm-hmm.
The key is the insulation and the energy recovery ventilator that makes sure. So one key is that the house isn't leaking heat or air conditioning out of the house, and it's not taking in the outdoor air temperature, but that you're controlling the exchange of fresh air for stale air and controlling the temperature of it.
Yeah, it is a variety of homes. The article shows pictures of some things that look very modern and others that just like your standard little square house.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Tell us about these students. You talk about the futuristic-looking house that went up last winter on the edge of the University of Louisiana campus in Lafayette, which students ran into, the first house in the southern part of the country to achieve official certification as a passive house.
Yes, it's funny because the students living there are actually architecture majors, and it was their professor who built the house. And the student I spoke to, he said he noticed the house because it looked very different. It was much more modern looking than the other houses in that area. Achieving passive house certification was quite a challenge for the architect, Corey Safe, because of the climate there. For the most part, these houses have been built in Northern Europe where it's pretty cold in the wintertime, but they don't have this problem of heat. So many of the projects in the U.S. have had to adapt themselves to the local climate. And the architect did a number of interesting things. He used something called a rain shield that actually, it's on one side of the building, and it actually provides shade, but it also allows the humidity to escape from the house, so it doesn't get trapped. And this house also has a lot of insulation, and not the kind of insulation we would think of here in the northern part of the country to keep the house warm. It's more to make sure that the mugginess doesn't enter the house.
Mm-hmm.
And they needed to put in a couple of units that provide air conditioning during the hotter time of the year, but because they're able to maintain the indoor temperature for the most part, those air conditioners don't have to run as much as they would otherwise.
Why is it that Europe has so many more of these not only passive homes, but passive factories, passive schools?
It's interesting because the architect, a gentleman by the name of Wolfgang Feist, who came up with this method back in the late 80s, early 90s, he was inspired by U.S. architects, by Amory Lovings and other architects who were building these very airtight houses back in the 70s. And he improved upon the work that they were doing in the 70s, and it really started to take off. And precisely, like, it's called passive house. But in German, a house isn't just a home, it's any kind of a building. And they've become, I think really you can look at the role of regulation there. In Europe, they've become, the governments have set much more stringent standards in terms of energy efficiency for homes and other buildings, and for the quality of the windows, for instance, energy efficient windows. And Europe is moving very quickly toward a much higher standard for new construction. By 2020, all new buildings will have to be much more energy efficient than they are today.
Mm-hmm. These statistics, I was not aware of these, that you cite in your article, almost half of U.S. greenhouse gas emissions come from our homes, 48%, roughly half of the nation's electricity comes from dirty coal-fired power plants.
Yes, that's very true, and it doesn't look like coal is going away anytime soon. So anytime that we can cut down on the amount of power yet needed to run our homes, it's a big help, especially about three-quarters of all of the energy generated by power plants is used to run buildings.
What about opening windows? Can you do that in these passive homes?
Actually, you can, and that's a question that comes up quite a bit. Because they are so, even among our architects, because they are so airtight, one thinks one doesn't want to open a window and ruin everything. But
right.
it's, It's kind of similar, you know, like you would do it at your own discretion. In the middle of the summertime, a very hot and sweltering summertime, if you have the air conditioning running at full blast, you're probably not going to open the window, right?
Right.
So the same would be the case with a passive house. But you can open windows, and actually that can help. I was in Germany earlier this year doing a tour of green building there, and we visited several passive houses, and one was a passive school. And when we walked into the school, it was about an hour or so after classes had gotten out, and so it was quite chilly in there. And I remember because it was springtime, and I didn't bring quite warm enough clothing for Germany, so I had been quite chilly the whole time. So when I walked into this room, and I knew we were going to be sitting there for an hour or so, I was thinking, oh, I'm going to freeze to death. But within about 10 minutes, the room had heated up. Our body heat had heated the room up enough that it was comfortable. And at one point, the gentleman who was giving us the tour opened up the windows to let a little heat out because it was getting a little too warm in the room.
Oh, my goodness. Let's go to phone calls for you. Dan is our first caller from Three Lakes. Hi, Dan.
Good morning. I think it's much simpler to explain this air-to-air heat transfer device. They've had them in Canada for 30 or 40 years. They've been required. And all it is a box that's in your heat duct, except it's made out of layers of corrugated material, just like any old cardboard, but this is made out of aluminum corrugations about the same size, and they're in layers so that they run, every other layer runs at right angles to the one next to it. And when they're stacked up in a long box that runs sideways in your heat duct, in your ductwork, the outgoing air goes into this box and out, up and out through the corrugations. The incoming air comes in and goes up and in through the intermediate corrugations. And in that way, the outgoing air, especially because it's made out of aluminum, which is a good conductor, the outgoing air heats the incoming air somewhat before it gets to your furnace or your air conditioner, whichever is going to happen first. And by the way, Amory Lovins is not an architect. He's a journalist, and he runs the Rocky Mountain News. That's all I have.
Well, I believe Amory Lovins was a pioneer in green building. But thank you for the explanation of how these recovery ventilators work. They are quite small, as the gentleman points out. One woman I interviewed said she was very impressed by the fact that her entire the entire mechanical system that was going to run the heating and cooling of her home could fit in a closet she thought she would use as a linen closet. So we're talking a very small unit.
Are you familiar with what he said about Canada, that it's required in Canada?
No, I hadn't heard that, but it wouldn't surprise me because, given the climate in Canada and the fact that these devices have been around for quite a long time, it's also been described to me as a box that has a number of what look like almost to be straws inside, and the air passes through there, and basically the heat is what is culled and then and transferred onto the colder incoming air.
I was reading an article in another publication about a family that had one of these passive homes, and they relied on a wood-burning stove on the main floor of the house and electric radiant floors in the bathrooms. Do most passive homes have these kinds of floors, and can you tell me more about them?
Actually, you don't need to do any of that with a passive home, although you could combine. Radiant floor heating is becoming very popular in the U.S. in the green building arena, along with solar panels and other mechanisms for basically generating heat in a sustainable manner. But the beauty of the passive home is that instead of generating green energy, the house needs very little energy to function. Basically, you have a reduction of about 90% in terms of the amount of energy it takes to heat or cool the home, which can mean a difference. For instance, the house I mentioned in Maryland, it's a huge four square. It's more than 4,000 square feet, and the architect estimates that it will cost about $700 a year to heat and cool that house. when a conventional home of the same size and the same zip code would cost about $7,000 a year.
Wow.
And this is all without solar panels. He's making the home solar ready. So because one beauty of the passive house system is it needs so much less electricity that you can put fewer solar panels on your home and bring the house all the way down to carbon neutral or carbon negative in terms of the energy you're using.
Christine McDonald is our guest. She wrote the piece that's in the current issue of E, the Environmental Magazine, and it is about passive homes. She also, as you heard her say, traveled to Germany to look at energy-efficient homes in that country. The cover story, it is, of the Environmental Magazine, just add body heat. The new passive homes are so energy-efficient, they make heating and cooling practically irrelevant. Here's our phone number if you'd like to join the conversation, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this hour, Richard Wolff will be joining us. His book has just been released, Revival, The Struggle for Survival Inside the Obama White House. We go to Barney from Burlington. Hey, Barney.
Hi, good morning.
Hello.
I was going to ask if why can't we develop a newer version of the silicon glass window material where its technology is like 7,000 years old? And it's that version of glass only has a very weak resistance to heat transmission. I would hope with the knowledge and computers we now have, we could increase the efficiency from its present like R1.5 to 30 or 50 or more. What's going on there? Don't we think about things like this? Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Barney.
Well, I have to admit that I don't really know much about those types of windows that he mentioned, although it sounds like a very interesting field, and hopefully there will be some development there.
What about the kinds of windows that are used on these passive homes?
You can use a variety of types of windows. Some of the projects that I looked at actually imported windows from Germany or from Northern Europe. And other ones used windows made in Canada or the U.S. The market for what we have available to us here in the U.S. in terms of energy-efficient windows is not nearly as advanced as what you can get in Europe right now. And again, from what experts were explaining to me, it has a lot to do with regulation. Basically, the regulation has been has required more energy efficiency in Europe, and that has spawned market development. So an entire market has grown up around creating windows that are of a higher quality. And there's been some efforts in that direction here in the U.S., but we have definitely lagged.
I'm thinking of body heat and how important body heat is to these passive homes. Isn't it something what you were saying about your trip in Germany, that body heat can make that big a difference?
It is surprising, isn't it? We were maybe 30 people in the room, and it definitely warmed the place up. And another, it's because these homes only need to be warmed up a few degrees, give or take 5 degrees, they usually say, as opposed to, let's say it's a 40-degree day outside and you're in a conventional house. And you need the temperature needs to be warmed almost 30 degrees in order to warm up to a livable, comfortable indoor temperature. But if you have if you're in a passive home, you might be able to maintain a temperature in the 60s and only need to increase it slightly in order to make it a comfortable degree. And surprisingly, not just body heat, but things like the television set or the heat given off by conventional light bulbs can be it also contribute to warming the home.
Thanks, Barney, for your call. We go next to Terry in Abbotsford. Hi, Terry.
Hi, good morning. We built our super insulated house back in 1985, and I don't know why more people don't want them. Ours cost us between $100 and $150 a winter to heat.
So tell me, what did you build?
It's just a regular house. I mean, it's a good-sized house. We have 18-inch walls, which gives us insulation of R40 in the walls and R70 in the ceiling. We have the window quilts, which means that when you close these, they're a special sort of a shade. When you close them, they're sealed. They're quilted to keep the heat in or out.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of south-facing windows. That's the way we lined it up to have our living room and dining room and stuff. So the windows are south-facing to gather that heat. During the winter, if I want to warm the house up, I cook something. Like this Thursday when we have Thanksgiving, we'll have to open the windows because the house will get too hot.
Really?
And when we built it, it cost about $52,000, if I remember right. And a friend of ours who runs a lumber yard ran the numbers, and the extra insulation and having the 18-inch walls cost us about $2,500 extra than building a conventional home. And we certainly have recouped that many times over.
I guess you have.
I don't understand why people aren't building them. We would use so much less energy.
Right.
We have an air-to-air heat exchanger. So they're there.
Uh-huh. It's a little more expensive these days to build it, though, isn't it?
Well, the experts say that it should only cost about 10% more. But the builders I talked to said it could cost as much as 25% more. Mostly it has to do with the learning curve. For the builders. Several of the people I interviewed said they had to take a few steps forward and then a few steps back in order to get it right. These houses need to be planned well from the get-go, and sometimes there are more builders out there and subcontractors with the experience of building them, the price differential will probably come down quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. Terry, do you know others who have built homes like yours, or are you unique?
Well, yeah, we're unique. In fact, sadly enough, about 5 years ago, I needed some information from our builder, and he said that he had to quit building the super insulated homes because there was not enough demand for them. He just builds high-end, big, fancy homes. So it's like I say, I don't understand why the savings in energy and the comfort, and it's a little quieter, too, with the 18-inch walls. It's a no-brainer for me.
Right. I'm amazed that he's able to make a living building high-end fancy homes these days.
Well, that was 5 years ago, and I was talking to him, so.
Who knows
but
now?
Apparently, he couldn't make, there weren't enough people interested in building super insulated homes.
Is that a different story in Europe, Christine? There are more people who are interested?
Yes, there definitely seems to be, especially when I was in Germany. Germany, I think, is a leader in these things. And in general, people seem to be more concerned in part because of regulation and in part because of the high cost of fuel in Europe. And there seems to be more concern generally regarding global warming and environmental concerns surrounding carbon emissions.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Terry, very much for your call. Mary in Duluth, hi.
Hi. I just needed to talk about Amory Lovins a little. One of the previous callers was so dismissive about him.
Yeah.
Amory Lovins is an unbelievable pioneer in energy efficiency. A couple of years ago, I visited the initial Rocky Mountain Institute in Snowmass, Colorado. They also have an office in Boulder, Colorado, where most of their scientists and engineers work. And they have been instrumental all over the world helping major international companies reduce their energy consumption. And I would encourage anyone to Google their work. It is stunning. It is outstanding. It's an unbelievable example of what can be done and should be done.
Okay, and how do we Google that? Mary?
I think you can Google Amory Lovins or Rocky Mountain Institute.
Sure.
And, I mean, it's just an aha moment and an amazing awareness to people in the United States who seem to be so resistant. He has been acknowledged, like I say, he started this work about 30 years ago. And, by the way, the initial place in Snowmass, Colorado, was being heated because of the way it was constructed for a bill of $4 of energy consumption a month. Now, that's in Snowmass, Colorado.
Oh, that's quite something.
There's a lot we can learn from this gentleman and from his work and the work that not only the Institute has done, but the work that the Institute has influenced all over the world.
Christine.
I would have to echo the, this woman's comments. I think it's very true. He has been inspirational and been a very important part of not just the energy efficiency world, but he's been inspirational in terms of trying to come up with solutions to all of these environmental problems we have. The other gentleman also characterized him as a journalist, but he runs the Rocky Mountain Institute, not the Rocky Mountain News, which I believe is another organization.
Right. Thanks, Mary. We go to Kevin in Madison. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, how are you doing? I just want to first say thanks to Christine for being on. I appreciate her giving the support to this whole idea and movement in the United States.
Oh, thank you.
The thing I wanted to add was there's a Passive House in the Woods website about a passive house that just went up in Hudson, Wisconsin. It's from a designer architect out of Minnesota. I think he's from the Twin Cities with TE Studio, Tim Ian, who's originally from Germany and has taken this passive house idea and is pushing it in our area here. I've had extensive conversations with him and just the whole idea of passive house. In the process right now of designing and building in western Wisconsin, biggest concern is the cost of the building of a passive house. So I just wanted some ideas of how to kind of keep costs at a minimum.
You're building a house, Kevin?
Correct.
Oh.
What are the areas that you've been told are going to be the more costly areas of the house?
Just the whole idea of using this designer to put together the plan of building the passive house and then having to subcontract all of the work. Windows were one of the biggest things. You can't find any windows in this area, so they would have to be special ordered either from overseas or from out of the country for a passive house. Mm-hmm. The air filtration system to maintain the air. There are different levels you can purchase. If you buy a lower-end level, you have higher risk of, maintenance or malfunctions. So you typically want to go with a higher-end air filtration system, which can be pretty pricey.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting because I from the architects I spoke to, the insulation was higher, but they at least one or two felt that they would save some money on the mechanical system. But I think these things do vary from area to area of the country. And in terms of paying for the design work, that I've also heard that to be the case, because it's really important to think out all of the particular problems that you're obstacles that you have to hurdle in order to meet the certification. Because many of these houses, many of these projects, not all of them make passive house certification. You have to pass a blower door test, which is a test of how tight. Pretty much how well you've insulated the house. And some projects, for instance, the Park Slope Brooklyn retrofit that I wrote about may not pass the test and actually get its certification, even though it will be it's operating as a passive house, and it will provide a lot of benefits to the owners, but it might not make that stringent standard. Of the passive, you have to pass a very stringent test.
Is that a big deal to pass that?
Well, especially when builders are building these things and they on spec and they want to sell them, oftentimes they do want to get a certification because it helps them sell the house. But I was speaking to the owner of the Brooklyn house, for instance, and she felt if it didn't. They'd like it to pass the certification, but either way, she feels like they're already receiving the benefits of living in this
right.
house with great air quality and low, heating costs.
Is certification important to you, Kevin?
Yeah, absolutely.
It is.
The Passive House in the Woods website, it's more of a blog that TE Studios runs, was very helpful, too. So if anybody has you know, wants more information or wants to look more into that, it's passivehouseinthewoods.com. And okay. The house is located in Hudson, Wisconsin, and is regularly toured, so it's a pretty cool site.
Great. All right. We'll go to it. Thank you, Kevin. Good luck.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. Bye. Joanne is next from Nishkoro. Hi, Joanne.
Hi. I really appreciate this program. Anything we can do to lower the carbon emissions is great. I recently had to build a new house because I lost an old one to fire.
Oh.
And I built it Energy Star tight and with a geothermal heating system and one of the higher-end air exchangers. The problem I'm seeing is the air exchanger does not take the moisture out of the outside air when it brings it in. It exchanges the heat all right, you know. But so when I wash a few dishes by hand or a few clothes that shouldn't go in the dryer, the moisture is in the house, and I don't know, you know, when it's 60, 70, 100% humidity outside.
If you want that, you know, right.
I'm having moisture in my house. That,
is that something wrong with the system?
No, there's nothing wrong with the system. The system is not designed to take moisture out of the air. It's designed to take heat out of the air. My son lives in North Carolina, and he has a factory down there, and he had to spend like 3 or 4 times more for his air exchanger that would take humidity out of the outside air. So I'm just wondering if your guest has any ideas about that.
I think what you probably, the one you had, there are different ones. The one they use most commonly in Germany, for instance, is called a heat exchanger, and it doesn't take any humidity out. But the ones that in these more humid climates here in the D.C. area and further south, a lot of builders are using energy recovery ventilators that can handle humidity, but I'm sure that they must be more expensive for that reason.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense.
Well, you'd want to have that taken care of, wouldn't you? Wouldn't you worry about mold problems?
Well, it's not that bad. I mean, you know, if I just turn my heat up a little bit, then that goes away. But, you know, in the summertime, it was pretty interesting.
Right.
But anyway, I just wanted to caution folks that that's something they need to kind of look out for. I mean, I just have an Energy Star tight house, not a super insulated house. So I'm sure mine would exchange more air, you know, by itself.
Through the walls.
Without that, than the super insulated ones. And also the an odor issue, the air exchanger would get rid of that too real quickly. But we've had a very humid summer and even now, so I just... This is just something that folks might want to think about. That's all. I'm just.
I think Joanne brings up a very important point that in different regions of the country, there you need to have it's not a cookie cutter approach. These houses really need to be tailored to the particular climate and other concerns of the local area. And it is still a little bit of a because they're all so new. There's still a bit of trial and error going on here.
Right. And when she talks about she doesn't have a passive home, she has Energy Star. Do you know anything about the Energy Star? What is that?
Yes, that is you know, it's a federal standard, and it's much lower. I think the actual standard is 15%. The house has to be 15% more energy efficient than the conventional home built to 2004 standards. So a passive home, the standard for a passive home is, the rule of thumb is it will be about 90% less energy intensive to heat and cool. And overall, you know, taking into account your lights and all of your home appliances and television and all of that, it will bring down your electric bill by about 60 or 70%, basically.
Mm. Here's an email that's come in from Marty. I was wondering if these homes provide more air exchanges than normal homes and would therefore be more beneficial for allergy sufferers. I'm assuming the incoming air is filtered with a HEPA filter.
You can filter the air using these systems. And for instance, here in Washington, we have a lot of allergy issues in the summertime because there's so much greenery around. And these are the proponents of the system do claim that the air quality is much better, and there is a standard for air exchanges. It basically This is very technical, but it has to be plus or minus 0.6 air exchanges at 50 Pascal pressure in order to pass the blower door test. So basically, there is a constant flow of fresh air coming into the home, and you can filter out allergens and other things as it's coming into the home.
More phone calls in a moment. Passive homes is what we're talking about this hour of the program. A certified passive home using 90% less energy for heating and cooling than the average home, reducing total energy consumption to between 60 to 70% less than a conventional home. Our guest, Christine McDonald, has written the cover story in E! The Environmental Magazine on passive homes, and we're welcoming phone calls at 800-486-8655. A couple lines are open. Email talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our next caller is Matt in Lake Geneva. Hi, Matt.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a contractor here in the Lake Geneva area, and I think I understand something about why people are not so motivated to seek out these super insulated and passive homes. And that's because the conventional homes are so much more energy efficient than what many of us grew up with, that people don't really see the benefit in going the extra distance. And I'll give you an example. An older, like 60, 70-year-old, which there are many of around here, home of 2,000 square feet might cost $400 or $500 to heat in January, just in the month of January. But a typical new, well-built home might cost around $100 to heat. So the people are feeling pretty good about that already. And then adding additional costs for, like, heat exchangers and stuff like that, it just doesn't make sense to them. They like what they've got.
Uh-huh. Christine?
Well, I think it's true that there have been advances in construction over the years, but I think there's still, I mean, when you consider that 3/4 of the energy coming out of power plants is used in buildings, not in industry or other uses today, shows you that there's still a huge, there's still plenty of possibility for reducing that and reducing the country's carbon footprint by making our buildings more energy efficient.
And thanks, Matt, very much for your call. We go to Mitch in Green Bay. Hi, Mitch.
Hello. A lot of this stuff's been going on for quite a while. By the way, there's been energy testers and that paper here. There's been several articles in the Green Bay Press Gazette recently on energy saving and dial down your heat and stuff like that. But they show the people doing the testing and doing the blower door and everything else on these homes. Back in the 60s, 1960, my dad built a home in the western part of Waukesha County, and he had a great deal of political problems dealing with building inspectors and also with several builders. Had problems with them because they didn't want to go with a 2x8 wall so he would have sufficient insulation on them. And they didn't want to go with, at that time, the foam around the outside of the building at the foundation level. And they didn't, and he just did this stuff, plus a few other, more insulation in the attic. And his house, he had a 2,600 square foot house that he heated for the whole year, at about $240.
Woo!
Wow, yes.
They actually required him to put in a boiler that he had hot water, radiant hot water in several floors, plus radiators around different rooms in the house. There was a little baseboard radiators. They actually require him to put in a much larger boiler than he thought he needed, because they were doing it all on the specifications with a house with 2x4 walls and with half the insulation that he was putting in.
Uh-huh.
And he had insulating contractor that he had to fire because the man wouldn't meet his specifications. He was only going to put a single bat in the wall instead of filling up the wall spaces.
Hmm.
Well, he said, well, this is all I'm required to do, and this is what I bid on. And my dad said, well, here's the specifications I gave you, and how come you're not staying with the contract? He said, well, these are the regulations, sir, and I'm not going to deviate from the regulations.
Hmm. Christine.
Well, I think that's very interesting, experience with resistance to these new systems. But I think in recent years we're starting to see changes. I, if you look at the number of cities and towns and counties and states that have been adopting U.S. Green Building Council regulations, the LEED standard. And you see the increasing concern about energy efficiency with officials, both at the local level and at the state and federal levels. I think we're starting to see a change of approach, especially when it comes to new construction. But a big challenge that we're going to be facing, which the previous caller also alluded to, is new construction, regulation for new construction is becoming more stringent every day in terms of energy efficiency, but we have so many existing houses that need to be retrofitted. And in Germany and in Europe, that is beginning. There are federal funds that are, government funds that are available in many cases to help with some of those retrofits. And because of their regulations in terms of windows and other components, it's really driving the retrofit market in Europe in a way that we're not seeing here in the U.S. But I think we are moving in that direction, particularly in the new home construction. If you look at green building trends, green building has been growing tremendously, even during the economic downturn, while the rest of the building sector hasn't. And that's been attracting more and more mainstream builders, more contractors and sub contractors are becoming more familiar with these methods.
Right. It just takes a while for things to move along, doesn't it?
I think so. And actually, I was speaking with a guy who does mostly remodeling projects here in the Washington, D.C. area, and he was saying that he thinks green building and regular building, everything is going to be green building in 5 or 10 years. So things are moving in that direction. Hmm. There's just this merging of the two that's going on.
Thanks, Mitch, for your call. Ron in Willard is next. Hi, Ron.
Yeah, good morning. Yeah, I'm listening to your program, and I actually built a passive solar home. I think it's about 18 years old now here in the Willard area. And I used, when I did the research, I came across an architect by the name of Alex Wade, W-A-D-E. He was in Massachusetts, but he had written a number of books about passive solar houses, and one of them is called Affordable Housing, or The Affordable House by Alex Wade, which I would recommend if you can still find it in some libraries. It's been out of print for a while, to help people get a reference for building passive solar. We've lived in this home for, as I said, about 18 years, and we don't have a heat exchanger, but because the center of the house is open to the roof, we have high windows on the south side and low windows on the north side, and if we need to ventilate, we simply crack a couple of windows and ventilate out the moisture when we need to. We have 6-inch walls, and the building faces 10 degrees east of due south. So we pick up a lot of heat when the sun shines in the winter, and of course the coldest days in the winter are when the sky is clearest. So we get a lot of heat pouring in here, and even on severe below zero days, we're up above 80 degrees in here, and I have to vent heat out during the afternoon to make it comfortable.
Hmm.
And do you find that you get enough ventilation? You can the moisture by cracking the windows. That's enough to because I've been told in some of the older passive homes they were so tightly insulated that mold and condensation became an issue. Have you had?
Well, it's been an issue off and on. We do need to right on top of venting. You know, when the moisture builds up, we do need to vent. I don't have a vent in the bathroom for the shower, but the shower, the whole building is built out of timber frame. So there's a internal walls are timber frame construction as well, and the same thing in the bathroom. So above the 7-foot walls that separate the shower from the rest of the bathroom, that's open. So the moisture comes up above the walls and comes into the rest of the house very easily. And if I open the top windows, which are at about 16, 17 feet up on a walkway that walks across from one side of the building to the other to connect the two lofts, the ventilation will go out. You know, there was a fellow on Larry Mueller within the last week or two, contractor who has been building homes for a while. By the way, after I built this house, people came and looked at it, and they said, would you build me one? So I said, well, I'm not going to do the labor because it took me 2 years of labor to actually build a house.
You actually did the building?
Yeah, actually.
Good for you.
Did the building.
That's great.
With the help of many friends, I might add.
Uh-huh.
And so I said, well, yeah, I'll do the general contracting, but, you know, the labor I'm not going to do. So I ended up actually building about 6 more homes.
Oh, wonderful.
Doing the general contracting, two right very close by, the neighbors of mine, and then others in other parts of central western Wisconsin. But anyway, I lost my train of thought where I was before I was talking about building these additional homes.
Well, one thing you mentioned was the affordability of these homes, which I'd like to comment on. We aren't seeing too many really affordable homes of this type quite yet. Many of the projects I looked into were very high-end homes. You know, like the Washington area home. It would qualify for McMansion status. And because the people who are building them are really early adopters, we're usually talking about pretty well-heeled people with a lot of sophistication and concern about the environment. Although we may see these trickling down. The architect who actually designed the McMansion going up here in the suburbs of Washington told me that he has knocked on all the doors of all the affordable housing agencies in the area and has tried to interest them in affordable projects, and he continues to work in that regard. But and so we may be seeing more affordable projects, both in terms of government-funded ones and more affordable, you know, middle-class homes as time goes on.
Thanks, Ron. We have time for maybe one or two calls. We'll see if we can get to two. Hi, Jane, wherever you are. Jane?
Hi.
Yeah, go right ahead, please.
I just had a comment for the lady that was having problems with her moisture on her air exchanger. I found out in our house, our air exchanger is not to be used in the summer because it pulls in all the moisture if it's a cheaper air exchanger, and it actually kind of rusted out our furnace. So in the summer, we have to turn it off, but we can still, like, if there's, like, you know, a burn smell or something in the house, we can still run it, but it won't. It'll just exchange the air in the house instead of pulling in fresh air from outside.
Mm-hmm. The more we do this show, the more I'm thinking you got to get a good air exchanger, Christine. What do you think?
I think you're right. Yes, I think that's a very key part of this, and you maybe do the research and make sure you're getting one that's right for your part of the country so that you can get rid of the moisture if you need to.
Right. You need to keep track of that. Well, where do you think? Make a prediction for us. You think we'll see how many new passive homes in this country within the next 20 years? Huge number?
This is a very tested system in Europe. I mean, there are tens of thousands of these buildings have already been built. So
isn't that something?
Yeah, we've only, in terms of certified passive houses in this country, there are only about a dozen right now. But since it is a time-tested approach, I think we will see many more. But whether it will go mainstream, that is a harder question to answer.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for being with us and for writing the article and drawing our attention to this. It was very interesting.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Mm-hmm. Our guest is the author of the piece that is on the current issue of E! The Environmental Magazine. And you can that Passive House in the Woods website. We should all go to that because I understand that it's pretty neat, which I believe it would be. We thank our guest for being with us to talk about passive homes, Christine McDonald. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour and to Chrissy as well for on-air production. Tomorrow during this time period, the book is just released and starting to get some attention. Richard Wolff will be with us. He's been examining the Obama White House for some time and is the author of the just-published Revival, The Struggle for Survival Inside the Obama White House. Richard Wolff joining us during this time period tomorrow, award-winning journalist and political analyst. Thank you for calling. Thank you for listening. And we'll be with you tomorrow. Great conversations ahead on the Ideas Network.